Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Today we have stories about a dark money lawsuit, Bozeman's newest affordable housing project, and an interview with Democratic candidate for Montana Secretary of State, Bryce Bennett. It's Thursday, August 29th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. The controversy over the Pacific Northwest National Scenic Trail's route through grizzly bear habitat in the Yaak Valley is headed to court. As Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports, the Yaak Valley Forest Council filed a lawsuit Friday claiming that the U.S. Forest Service failed to evaluate the impacts of the trail on grizzly populations.
The roughly 1,200-mile Pacific Northwest Trail, not to be confused with the Pacific Crest National Scenic Trail, would wind from Glacier National Park to the coast of Washington State. Some have hiked the entire trail. Some sections follow established tread, while large sections are unmarked and cover rugged terrain, including the Yaak Valley, where grizzly bear numbers are relatively low. The Yaak Valley Forest Council, a grizzly-focused environmental group based in the Kootenai National Forest, prefers an alternative route to the south near Libby. The group filed a lawsuit over the current route in the U.S. District Court in Missoula on August 23rd. The suit argues that the Forest Service did not properly evaluate the impact the route would have on threatened grizzlies in the Yaak Valley. It also says the management plan for the PNT was not issued within a two-year timeline after Congress designated the trail in 2009. The advisory group in charge of laying the groundwork for that plan is currently not meeting. The Yaak Valley Forest Council is asking the court to require the Forest Service to create the PNT management plan on an expedited timeline and to prevent the agency from, quote, advertising the trail's route until it has conducted a NEPA analysis. Requests for comment from the Yaak Valley Forest Council were not returned in time for this story. The Forest Service declined to comment, citing the ongoing litigation. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
An Illinois advocacy group is suing Montana Governor Steve Bullock over one of his trademark campaign finance policies targeting so-called dark money in politics. The lawsuit announced yesterday asks a federal judge to strike down Montana's almost year-old policy that requires certain businesses seeking contracts with the state to disclose donors and spending on elections. Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates Carney reports.
The filing in U.S. District Court in Montana says Illinois Opportunity Project plans to send thousands of mailers to Montana voters in the final months of the state's 2020 race for governor.
This case is about the First Amendment.
Daniel Sir is an attorney with the Liberty Justice Center, which is representing Illinois Opportunity Project in the case. The group, whose website says it promotes policy advancing, quote, free markets and free minds, unquote, writes in its legal filing that it hopes to urge Montana candidates not to support campaign finance policies like those of Governor Bullock.
This nation has a long and proud history, stretching all the way back to the Founding Fathers and the Federalist Papers, of people engaging in the public square based on their ideas and the power of their ideas, not based on their name or who's paying for it or publishing it, but based on the strength of the ideas themselves.
Sir is talking about anonymous advocacy or spending in politics, what some others, like Montana Governor Steve Bullock, refer to as dark money.
You know, if folks want to try to buy our elections, Montanans expect we at least know who's doing the buying.
Bullock has built much of his political identity as a campaign finance reformer, first as Montana's attorney general and governor, and now as a presidential candidate. The executive order he signed in June of 2018 make state agencies require potential contractors selling more than $25,000 in services or $50,000 worth of goods to disclose money given to candidates, political parties, or other groups paying for electioneering communication. The order was praised by advocates for campaign finance transparency for pushing Montana's policy a step further than most other states.
This is just some out-of-state, actually dark money group that wants to sue us, and we don't even know who funds them.
The lawsuit this week says Bullock's order for certain government contractors to reveal their political spending violates free speech and privacy rights. The Liberty Justice Center's Daniel Sir says political donors could be harassed or retaliated against because of their support for certain issues, and the First Amendment to the United States Constitution protects anonymous issue advocacy. The court filing argues that if Bullock's executive order remains state policy, the Illinois group will, quote, chill its own speech and not engage in its desired communication, unquote. The case has been assigned to Judge Charles Lovell. A hearing has not yet been set. According to the governor's office, Bullock's executive order applies to an estimated 500 to 600 state contracts a year. I'm Corin Cates-Carney, Montana Public Radio.
An association of oil and gas industry members from Montana met in Billings this week to talk about issues the industry is facing, like transporting crude oil. Kayla DeRoche reports from the third day of the annual meeting.
During a break between talks, Montana Petroleum Association Executive Director Alan Olson says policies in other states are affecting the price of crude oil.
Oil in Montana is running a little bit less than West Texas price, but that's primarily due to transportation issues. But, I mean, we're still seeing probably an average of $48 to $50 a barrel.
He says Washington state's restriction on crude oil trains from Northern Plains states has something to do with that. In May, Washington Democratic Governor Jay Inslee signed a bill intended to decrease the likelihood of oil spills due to derailment. The legislation prevents facilities from unloading crude oil with vapor pressure more than 9 pounds per square inch and affects the transport of Bakken oil, which is especially volatile. Montana Attorney General Tim Fox and North Dakota Attorney General Wayne Stengem are asking the federal government to reverse the legislation. They see it as a state exception that is unnecessarily limiting to the oil and gas industry. Olson says the Montana Petroleum Association supports the attorneys general and says moving crude oil brings money into Montana.
If we don't have the ability to move the oil, we don't get a price. If we don't get a price, we don't pay taxes. It's just as simple as that.
During a 10-minute speech at lunch, Republican U.S. Senator Steve Daines voiced his intention to advocate for the oil industry.
And lastly, the reason this is important, and the reason it's important that we have common sense leaders back in Washington, D.C., is, as you know, it's one thing to be able to produce oil and natural gas. It's another thing to be able to transport it. And so the battles we're facing right now are some of these crazy East Coast and West Coast governors.
Like Attorney General Tim Fox, Daines talks about bringing the protest against the Washington state legislation to federal courts. Kayla DeRoche, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
Tuesday, the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes kicked off a Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Conference to raise awareness about the work being done to understand the scope of the issue, both on the reservation and in the state. Olivia Reingold is there. She shared her reporting with Nikki Willette.
Olivia, this is the second Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Conference the Flathead tribes have held since passing a resolution back in January. What was that resolution about, and how does this conference fit into that?
Well, the resolution that the tribes passed back in January does a few different things. First, it established a work group to address the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous people, but it also required the tribe to promote education and awareness about sexual assault, runaways, and drug use, and how that relates to missing and murdered Indigenous people. But its main goal of the resolution is to really develop an action plan, which is part of what this conference is working towards.
Who's all participating in this three-day conference?
So about 50 people showed up today, and there were all sorts of different people there. There was tribal law enforcement, social workers, nurses, members of the faith community. But all in all, people really wanted to know how they could help identify people who might be the victims of sex trafficking. And that's why one woman I spoke with, Johnny Sloan, a bus driver for the Ronan School District, came today. She said she was there to learn how she could help students.
The populations that I work with and the people that I see, I want to know how to identify, because I know that I have at-risk kids on my bus.
What other concerns did you hear from people specifically about sex trafficking?
Well, during this one exercise, everyone wrote down the risk factors they thought were present in their community for people who might be vulnerable to sex trafficking. And I spoke with Lisa Shorts, who's an administrative manager for the tribe's legal office, and I asked her what she wrote down, and she said she sees people connect more on social media than in person nowadays.
The first thing I came up with was lack of sense of community.
And tell me, what does that mean in a practical sense when you say that?
We used to have a sense of community as tribal culture, and we kind of are getting away from that. We're getting more into individuality, and so we really aren't having any gatherings like we used to support each other.
Aside from not having a physical sense of community, what were some of the other risk factors that were identified?
Most of the training today was run by a woman named Jerry Muma, who is a former survivor of sex trafficking. And she travels the country doing education about sex trafficking and how to prevent it. And she listed a handful of risk factors, from being in foster care to growing up around substance abuse. But she said that Native American women are particularly vulnerable to sex trafficking because of risk factors like this.
Well, when you look at kind of vulnerabilities, and human traffickers really target individuals with vulnerabilities and individuals that don't have stable support systems. And that could be somebody that is in the foster care system, somebody who has childhood sexual abuse at home. You know, there could be substance abuse in their home.
You mentioned that tourism in the Flathead, which is one of the biggest economic drivers of that region, but actually tourism can be can put people at risk. How does that?
Yeah, so tourism is a big industry in the Flathead Valley. And I spoke with Jamie Pluff, who's the tribe's policy analyst. And she said that she's concerned about all the people who move through the reservation.
That's what we worry about, because our reservation on each end, there's a truck stop in Kalispell and there's a truck stop in Missoula. And so it is worrisome. I mean, I worry about the young girls that when I'm driving from here to Polson and I see a young girl walking along the road, it's really scary.
So what's on the schedule for Thursday?
So Thursday we'll focus on working towards an action plan and response to missing and murdered Indigenous people. We'll hear from the tribe's work group and families of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Then in the afternoon, people will start to focus on building the policy in response to everything they've learned so far.
Olivia, thanks for sharing your reporting.
Thank you.
Construction on Bozeman's newest affordable housing project begins this week. Rachel Kramer reports there's a wait list of 200 individuals and families.
At a three-acre plot of land in northwest Bozeman, City Commissioner Terry Cunningham addresses a group of affordable housing advocates and community leaders Wednesday afternoon.
The American dream, I think, has a catchphrase, and that is, I'm home. Home is where we ground ourselves, and a home is where we put down roots. It's where we build our stories, and it's where we make a lifetime of memories.
This is the site of Willow Springs Townhomes, a new $6.5 million development that will include 24 units for households making between $30,000 and $40,000 a year. That's about 70% of the city's median income. The nonprofit organization Human Resource Development Council is developing the project under the Community Land Trust model to make sure homes remain affordable past the first sale. That means a homeowner can only sell a unit close to the original subsidized price rather than the market price. Heather Grenier is HRDC's CEO and president. She says the need for affordable housing is a big challenge for this community.
We have, I think, more than 200 families on the wait list that are ready, that have gone through home buyer education, have been determined eligible, and are excited to see this come off the ground as well.
Grenier says the Bozeman housing market has gone up about 8% over the last year. The median sale price of a home in Bozeman is over $400,000. A two- or three-bedroom Willow Springs townhouse will be less than a quarter of a million. Grenier says the project has had several delays, mostly due to building costs.
We actually had it out to bid a year ago, and the cost came in too high, and we had to wait and find some additional funding sources to be able to make it happen. And so it's finally all come together, final plat's done, building permits are drawn, and we're really excited to move forward and actually make some affordable homes.
Families have been selected for the first 12 units, which are slated to be completed April 2020. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
Candidates for statewide offices in Montana are gearing up for next year's primaries. Democratic Montana Senator Bryce Bennett announced his campaign for Secretary of State in May. He spoke with me about advocating for voting access, election security, and how he'd work across the aisle if elected. Thank you so much for coming and speaking with us today, Senator Bennett. Your past work experience outside the legislature is closely tied to politics and voter rights, first with Forward Montana and then Montperg. Can you describe how your past experiences might influence you as Secretary of State?
You know, the work that I've done before has been about advocating for voting rights and making sure that more people are able to participate in the process. And, you know, I've done a lot of work out in knee-deep snow trying to make sure that people are registered to vote. And no matter whether people were Republicans or Democrats or independents or somewhere in between, I've tried to make sure that more people have access to their democracy.
After foreign interference with the 2016 presidential election, what would you do to make sure Montana's elections are secure?
Security is a priority for me. I want to make sure that everyone has absolute confidence that their vote will be counted and their voice will be heard on election day. I want to partner with the National Guard cybersecurity unit to make sure that our security, both at the county level as well as the state level, is more secure than we've seen in ages. I want to make sure that any foreign adversary or domestic adversary that's trying to hack into our system would be foolish to even try.
If you're elected as Secretary of State, you would most likely be working with a majority Republican legislature and possibly a Republican governor. How do you work across the aisle without compromising on what you've promised your constituents?
You know, I've served in the minority for all five sessions that I've been involved with, and despite that, I've been able to pass a number of bills to make sure that our elections are accessible to the voters, to make sure that our democracy is secure so that no one's trying to hack into it, and making sure that our elections are accountable to the people of Montana so that it's not dark money or special interests that are trying to run our elections. And despite the fact that I've always been the minority, I've gotten a lot of important things done, and I could do it again.
Can you give me a couple of specific examples of times where you were in the minority fighting for something that maybe you got some pushback from on the other side and were able to accomplish what you set out to do?
Absolutely. I think one of the best examples is a bill called the Disclose Act that we passed in 2015. It was a bill that brought Republicans and Democrats together to make sure that dark money isn't running the day here in Montana. We worked across the aisle. We found co-sponsors of both parties in both chambers and made sure that in our elections, every penny is accounted for and that our elections are transparent to the voters of Montana.
In your interview with Montana Free Press for their podcast, The Montana Lowdown, you talked about what you view as the voter suppression agenda in the Montana legislature. What policies do you see as voter suppression, and how do you propose to address them?
Sure. I think that every session we've seen efforts to try to make our elections a little bit harder to access by Montana voters. And that's certainly the opposite of what I want to bring to the Secretary of State's office. I want to make sure that our elections are open and accessible to all Montanans. So I'm going to push back on every effort that I see to try to take away opportunities to vote, trying to take away days that people can vote early, trying to take away the sort of IDs that people can use to identify themselves, or even taking away Election Day registration, which has been, you know, a safeguard for so many Montanans to ensure that they have access to their democracy. So I want to make sure that Montanans have more access, not less, so that every eligible Montanan has a chance to have their voice heard.
How do you plan on working with Montana's tribes to ensure that they have access to the polls?
You know, I think the voter suppression agenda that you just mentioned has been even more pervasive when it comes to tribes. I mean, we've seen efforts to send, you know, goons into some of these tribal voting locations to try to scare away tribal voters from being able to participate in their democracy. We've seen efforts to try to take away polling locations on tribal reservations. So I think that we have to be especially sensitive to making sure that the tribal members of Montana, those voters don't have additional barriers to be able to vote and have their voice heard in their democracy. That's a huge priority for me, which is why I'm traveling around Montana to talk with tribal leaders face to face about the issues they're facing.
Last election, Montana voters passed a law that limits the number of absentee ballots that can be dropped off by a single person. How do you see this impacting voter turnout in 2020?
I voted against that bill when it waded its way through the legislature, and I continue to oppose it because I think that Montanans understand that they're never going to give their ballot to somebody they don't trust. But what this bill actually did was make it harder for Montanans to vote. I know there's many people out there who, you know, will hand a ballot to a loved one or to a family member to make sure that their voice gets heard on election day. And unfortunately, I think that this bill is going to put up some of those artificial barriers that are going to make it harder for people to vote.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk with Yellowstone Public Radio.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. I look forward to being back soon.
That was State Legislator Bryce Bennett, who's running for the Democratic nomination for Montana Secretary of State in 2020. More campaign coverage is available on our website, ypradio.org. And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.